Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3 is an actor, a playwright, novelist, Eric Bogosian. His latest book tracks an assassination squad that consists of an accountant, a life insurance salesman, a newspaper editor, an engineering student, and a diplomat. And this might sound like the premise of a great novel, but instead it's a great new nonfiction work entitled Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian genocide. Eric will be at the Brookline, I should say the great Brookline Booksmith tonight at 7 o'clock. Eric, it's a real pleasure to meet you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for coming in, Eric. Well, you know, we spoke at the beginning of the show about how lots of us, including myself, knew nothing about this. So tell people what Operation Nemesis was.
Well, it's a remarkable story that I stumbled across when I was going to write a screenplay about just one of these guys, probably the best known, named Sogoman Tetlirian, who assassinated Talat Pasha. That story was known because he was arrested and there was a court case in Berlin in 1921, and he was acquitted. But what I didn't know, and what virtually no, most Armenians don't know about, it's never really been talked about, is that in fact he was just one member of something called Operation Nemesis that after the Armenian genocide set out to assassinate, knock off a number of the Turkish leaders who had been responsible for the genocide. And they successfully did this. And this operation, which was all over Europe, killing seven, eight major leaders, came from here, from Watertown, Mass., from Syracuse, New York, as you mentioned. These small businessmen pulled their resources and set these guys who had some experience with weapons to go over.
And the reason they took to vigilante justice was what?
Well, the genocide had, by 1921, begun to be sort of swept under the rug. There were other interests that were saying, let bygones be bygones. We want Turkey to be our ally. There was an ongoing fight with Kemal over there. These men, most of the men who were killed, had already been convicted of war crimes in absentia, but they weren't in British-occupied Constantinople at the end of the war, and so they hadn't been caught. They were spread out all over Europe. They were in Rome. They were in Berlin. They were in Tbilisi, and the assassins went and tracked them down and gunned them down.
The first killing you mentioned, you said some of us heard of, that was in Berlin, was it not? Was
yes.
That not in Germany? But I think you should spend more time on that for a second, because those of us who had heard about it, and I had just some distant memory of having read about this at some point, the original news accounts, interpretation of what had happened, were not a reflection of reality. This young man was perceived totally differently than, in fact, he was, because
yes.
People didn't know he was part of some deal, as you're describing this operation,
correct? Oh, yeah. Tetlirian was an experienced assassin. He had killed before, but when he was arrested, his cover story was that he was an engineering student in Berlin. It was 5 years after the genocide, and he had just happened to see Talat on the street. And since he himself was a survivor of the or claimed to be a survivor of the genocide, having seen his whole family killed right before his eyes, particularly his mother came to him in a dream and said, "How can you let this man live?" He went and got a pistol, and he gunned down Talat in the street. That is the story he told in court. That is the story that has endured, and many people believe that that's the true story. In fact, he was not an engineering student. He didn't just happen to be in Berlin. He was on assignment to track Talat and kill him. And
didn't he stay with the body because he is that not right? That because he wanted to get caught, was that not it? And
well, the
he wanted
truth,
the trial. What is the truth?
I mean, one of the things about my book was I had to go through a ton of material and parse what was true, what wasn't true, what were the myths and all the passed down stories over the years. He was assigned to stay by the body, and the idea was he would get arrested and there would be a big trial, and then the whole world would learn about the genocide. He actually, in the moment, ran off, was chased by the local crowd who didn't really understand. This was a fairly busy thoroughfare, Hardenbergstrasse. And they're, what just happened? The guy just got shot. He did it. And they're chasing him. They're beating on him. And then the police arrive and he's rescued. At that point, he sort of gets with the program, which is stick to this alibi and stick with it all the way through the court case. He was completely surrounded in court by other members of the conspiracy, although the court, they were invisible to the court. His translator, his defense attorney, all these guys were in on what had happened.
Eric, how long have you been researching and put together this book? This has to be a very long-term project.
This is the longest-term project I ever worked on. I've been on this for about 7 years. My first notes date to 2007. When I started it, I was just going to write a screenplay. I'm used to writing screenplays. I figured maybe give me 3 months. And then when I started doing more research, I fell into this bigger story, which has been covered before, but in books that people don't really know about. And then it was like, how can people not know about this? So it wasn't just tell this story, but also I honestly don't know enough about the genocide. I don't know. I couldn't really tell you where Armenia was. I didn't know World War I history. I don't know anything about the Ottoman Empire. I've heard of it, but I didn't know what it was. So I thought part of my job here is when somebody reads this book, they're going to be introduced to, and it's got to be in a way where you can, you know, fall. It can't be like a homework assignment. It's got to be readable and interesting. In my mind, it was like a long Vanity Fair article, like something you just can't put down. Like, wow, I never knew this about sultans, or I didn't know this is what a harem was, or all these things. And when you put it all together, you end up with this historical event, which is pretty incredible. I mean, there's a genocide, yes, but the people who were part of that group made a decision to knock off all the people responsible for the genocide, and they did it from here.
Do you feel sympathy? When you were researching this and you're writing this, do you feel sympathy for the, for lack of a better expression, the assassins, those who were getting revenge for what was done?
Well,
to their
people? This is what made the story so interesting for me, because this is very key. When you know you must do something, even when it's against the law, what are we talking about? We're talking about a moral imperative. They felt that what had happened to the Armenians and their people, their families, their nation, was a crime beyond the imagination. I mean, literally entire towns, Sogamon Tetlerian's town, 25,000 Armenians had been just killed in a matter of days. And so they had to come back with some kind of response. And how can you blame them? And when you believe that these are the men responsible for it, sure, the law says you can't hunt them down and kill them, but there's a higher law. And I believe that was what.
So what do you say in 2015 to people who would say the same thing? A Palestinian, maybe even, we were just talking about, and believe me, I'm not arguing for this. I'm just saying that if you were able to sit down, as Sister Helen was able to do with Jahar Tsarnaev, he might say, I was doing the exact same thing. I was exacting revenge. I had a moral imperative to do what I did. Because of what was done to my people. How do you connect those dots?
Well, of course, everything ends up existing in the context of law, as did Tetlerion. I mean, Tetlerion didn't tell the truth in court, and that's why, if he had said, I came here to track down Talat and kill him, I doubt he would have been cut loose. So there is the law, and then there is your internal law. I can't argue anybody's internal law to them. And I'm sure, as you say, many people believe that they have to do whatever they have to do in most political violent crimes. This is an instance that just which speaks to me directly. I lost two of my great-grandfathers were killed by the Turks, and I've heard many stories. One particular grandfather, not great-grandfather, was a survivor. And I hear it. It speaks to me. It speaks to my heart. Of course, we live in a world of law, but we also live in a world of moral imperative. We all have to make decisions every day about what is right and what is wrong. And even though this was against the law, this was right, as far as I'm concerned, what they did. Now, the book actually doesn't just stay there. I go into some other instances of violent acts, and I look at them a little bit differently in the rest of other violent acts that were committed by Armenians over the decades after this period. And I really, anything I work on, whether it's a movie or whatever I work on, is really an extended meditation. I actually don't like people telling me what to think, so I'm not going to tell anybody. You read it and you decide what.
By the way, it does read like a thriller when you pause mid sentence when Eric just said, "I really don't like people," and then you continue. You know, I hope you take this in the right way. Well, you couldn't take it the wrong way. I saw talk radio in New York City about, what was it, 30 years ago, 28 years ago,
60 or 70 years
whatever,
ago.
Whatever. I closed my eyes, if I hadn't heard you speak in the interview, I would know. It's like it brings it back. I want to talk about that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
These microphones.
But can we
too.
Say when you were a kid, you mentioned relatives who had been victims, and then in the case of I think one grandfather's survivor. As a little kid, how much did you know about the Armenian genocide?
Well, I knew it, in I had been told stories. Now, what those stories mean to a six-year-old, yeah. I just can't even say at this point. They were so far away. It was a place so far away. It was a level of violence that didn't exist at all in my life. So I don't know where I put those things. And they kind of put on the shelf, basically, in my mind, mythic stuff that my grandparents, who are more familiar with a foreign language, they were the ones who told me the story. And honestly, in the 90s, as a more mature man, as I guess I was in my 40s at the time, I started to revisit this stuff and think. I had done the movie with Adam Egoyan, Ararat. I had read Peter Balakian's book. And the war was going on in Serbia. And all of those things made me start to think, wait a minute, what happened to my grandparents? I want to know the details. I want to know seriously. And by that point, of course, they had passed away. I couldn't ask them directly. And the research that I did actually eventually made it really bloom fully in my mind to a point where I don't even know what to do with some of this information. I mean, some of the things that were done are so horrific, they can't even be described. I barely describe them in the book, but they're beyond the imagination. So I don't know what my grandparents were holding within their own souls. And the people at my church when I was a little kid, they carried. In fact, there are people today that I'm meeting on this book tour who are still carrying this weight in a big way because their parents had been so seriously traumatized by their experience. They're, old people. That people tell me about my mother cried every day. Every day, my whole life, my mother cried. And this is somebody who grew up in that, so now they too are carrying this weight. I'm about as serious as most people in our society today. I just watch a lot of TV, and I live in America. I've never had to experience any true bad stuff, but this is. I try my best to rise to the occasion with this material.
We're talking to Eric Bogosian. The new book, nonfiction, is entitled Operation Nemesis, the Assassination Plot that Avenged the American Genocide. The American Genocide. Yeah. It was the Armenian Genocide, excuse me. But I want to ask you, Eric, though, there's been, as you know, and you've talked about and addressed it, but for our listeners, about the whole controversy, do we call it a genocide, do we don't call it a genocide? The Pope said it was a genocide. Obama has not yet.
Despite having pledged on the campaign trail that he would.
Said it was a genocide. Where do you come down on this genocide issue?
Oh, well, it's a genocide. There's no other way to look at it because when Raphael Lemkin defined genocide in the 1940s, he specifically cited the Armenians as a prime example. So there's no question about it being genocide. If you're going to parse the thing moment by moment, as opposed to, let's say, massacres or civil wars or something, then we're saying, okay, was it a systematic, centrally organized attempt to completely eradicate a people? The answer to that question is yes. And I explain that in detail in the third chapter of the book, which is they took all the young men, they put them in the army, took their guns away and had them all killed. Then they killed all the major, anybody who could possibly be a leader, an intellectual, or even a doctor, anybody. Those guys were arrested, tortured, killed. And then finally, the old people, the women, the children, were sent into the deserts to die. So there's no question that it was an attempt to completely, and they were pretty successful. There were something like 2.5 Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire at the beginning of the war, and there were under 100,000 people who call themselves Armenian by the end of the war.
So how upset with Obama are you?
Well, the Obama situation is weird because it's almost the theater of the absurd. He had been one of the most eloquent speakers on the genocide. He didn't just say he would say the word. He explained why it was a genocide. Then he hires Samantha Power to be part of his cabinet, another eloquent speaker on the genocide.
She did a video during his first campaign. Specifically saying vote Obama because of his position on the Armenian genocide.
So what can you say? I mean, there are people who make very forceful arguments that should the United States, the most powerful country on earth, care about what Turkey says they should do or not do? On the other hand, the issue today vis-a-vis ISIS is super serious. And if Turkey is going to be stupid enough to say, oh, you say genocide, we're not going to let you refuel your jets in the eastern part of our country, the president has to look at this. I won't defend him. But I think what his actions spoke for themselves.
That's Eric Bogosian. Eric, can we switch gears for a second back to what I was describing a couple of minutes ago? What was it? Barry Champlain? Was that what the name of the... Is that what it was?
Barry Champlain and talk radio,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Is Barry Champlain... And you should describe briefly if you can. I assume most people either saw it or saw it on stage or saw the movie or whatever. Does Barry Champlain still exist? What is it, 25, 28 years later? Could you write the same piece
today? Oh, absolutely. I mean, we see new versions of him all the time, but... if you're a fairly smart person and you know how to present yourself on the mass media and you just basically make a lot of noise that gets a lot of attention, you know what? You can make a lot of money. You can get a lot of one of the things I was looking at with the film and with the play is that we in the entertainment world or the mass media or whatever the hell this all is, we're not just here to, some of us, you know, you're going to make some money, but many of us want people listening to us talk, looking at us. We understand that is it a good part of us or is it a bad part of us? It's what makes us. And so that was very much what I was looking at. This guy, he watched his ratings go up. And pretty much every 2 or 3 years, we see somebody like this they don't say things that are consistent. Sometimes they're very, very clever, like a Rush Limbaugh, who somehow has managed to say one thing. And I mean, that man cheerleaded us into the Iraq War, which is one of the most horrible, sinful things that have ever been done to the young people in our country, to murder all those young soldiers in that way. This war was a giant mistake. We knew it going in. And a guy like Rush Limbaugh and other men like him who now want to wash their hands that they really, oh, it was a bunch of bureaucrats or whoever got us into the war. No, I'm sorry. You got us into this war. And I blame you. But somehow these guys managed to... I'm sorry, I'm on the radio.
No,
I'm talking about your
wonderful
competition.
That's
here.
That's okay.
It's
fine.
What it really comes down to is you can grease the wheels of your own... your numbers. We all have numbers.
Right.
We all have a brand. By saying these things that really catch attention, make headlines and so forth. And that was something that I was looking at with this guy because he pretty much will say anything and he hits this extreme. The whole thing with that particular drama was the thing was solved as a drama when I invited one of the audience members into the studio and he's completely nutto. And now Barry is facing his biggest fan. And I think all of us can say we've all met our biggest fans and sometimes are a little disappointed. I mean, you meet these people in the street like, Mr. Bogosian, I'm your biggest fan. You know, and it's like, really? Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. But that's the nature of the mass media. You don't even really know where it's all going out to. I mean, this has nothing to do with what you just asked me, but you know, I was on Law and Order for 60 episodes. I played Captain Danny Ross. I love doing it. I love Law and Order.
It's
I love all
show.
The guys doing the show. It's great. It has definitely impacted on the distribution of this book. If you can find a connection between what my book is about, Operation Nemesis, and Law and Order, I don't know, I guess it has something to do with law. But I mean, the fact that one thing can have an effect on another, it's all about the mass media. I have some sort of presence. And that helps get the book out there.
But when you wrote this many years ago, were you talking about Limbaugh or were you talking about a compilation of people?
This is pre-Limbaugh, wasn't it?
Pre-Limbaugh.
Yeah, so who are you talking about?
Pre-Howard Stern. I was actually talking about a guy named Alan Berg, and he got assassinated. But I was actually talking about somebody before Alan Berg. This is going to sound confusing. A guy named Alan Burke, who was on TV in New York City. And his thing was to bring guests on. Like somebody would be like into yoga or vegetarianism or something, and then he would make fun of them and so the audience would just have a great time making fun of this nudist or whatever it was he had brought on, and it was just this bloodbath every night on. And I happened to see it one time when I was in New York, and I decided I would make something like a guy who would just say anything. While I was writing the play, you mentioned the play, which was 28 years ago, Alan Berg
was killed,
was assassinated by the Aryan Nation. And that became wrapped into the story that we told in the movie.
So do you think when you look at the media then and the media now, same, worse, in the context of this whole kind of shock jock sort of thing?
Have you ever gone sledding and you think you know how fast the slope is going and suddenly starts going a lot faster?
Okay.
I think that's where the mass media is today. We really don't know what the social media... We watch as things start moving much faster than we ever thought they would. Because those of us who grew up around radio or TV, we started to understand by the 80s, this is something that's very, very, very powerful. And incredible things can happen. But with the when you include social media, it starts to, you know, by geometric progression, it's just moving faster and faster. And we never... Look, the Kim Kardashian in Yerevan event. Wow, where did that come from? All of a sudden... And Kim Kardashian, who is somewhat of a notorious character, becomes kind of a heroic character by giving her time and going there. So that fascinating stuff.
Eric, it's great to meet you.
Book. Congratulations on a great job on the your whole career, but this is a great book. Eric Bogosian is an actor, playwright, monologist. Thank you. And author. You know, some radio talk show hosts have to go to speech class. You know what I mean? His latest book is Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian genocide. And Eric will be at the Brookline Booksmith tonight at 7 o'clock. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. Eric. And you want to tell us what's on television tonight, Jim?
Well, actually, Senator George Mitchell has written a new book called The Negotiator about what he did in Northern Ireland, in baseball, in the U.S. Senate, that sort of thing. And we have both sides represented in the battle between the governor and the legislature over the tea.
Thank you, Chelsea, Will, Amanda, Catherine, John Parker, our engineer. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in, and please tune in again tomorrow. Bye.